NHL Awards night. It's a night of awards. Modest Yahoo's gonna be there, and probably Colin Hanks. NHL Awards night. Think about how far we've come, ladies and gentlemen, in the NHL Awards. When it was a scant few years ago, we were at the Palms in Las Vegas, and Chaka Khan was the big lead entertainment act. We've come a long way, ladies and gentlemen. Now it's Modest Yahoo, and it's at a different casino in Las Vegas. The win. It's very exciting. NHL Awards tonight, Hall of Fame announcements yesterday. It's me, Greg Merrick, off today, back tomorrow. And we have Helene St. James from the Free Press and Adrian Dater, everybody's favorite from the Denver Post, both talking about the Hall of Fame, both talking about the NHL Awards, and both talking about what their teams are going to do in the offseason, which means a spirited discussion with Mr. Dater about the future of Paul Stastny and the Colorado Avalanche, as it looks like he may either be pricing his way out of town or taking a bit of a discount to stay with the Avs. NHL Awards tonight, you know, it's one of those nights where, like, they're holding the awards and everybody's out there and people are golfing and Jonathan Toews is wearing seersucker shorts and it's a whole thing. But as far as the awards actually go, is anybody going to be really shocked? Is there one award that's going to be a shock tonight? Is there anything that isn't already predetermined insofar as who the winners are going to be? You take the Hart Trophy, right? You take the Hart. You got Sid, you got Claude Giroux, you got Ryan Getzlaff. It's obviously going to be Sid. Not only because he fulfills the obligation of the most valuable player in the league, but if you are one of those people that believes the Hart Trophy should be some sort of de facto best player in the NHL award, well, he also fulfills that obligation as well. Is it going to be the Norris Trophy? Zdeno Chara, Duncan Keith, and Shea Weber. That's one where I feel like there is the opportunity for an upset, although I think the majority of the voters probably gave Keith the award based on point total, based on the just overall solid nature of the Chicago Blackhawks and him being a representation of that. And I feel like there's always this notion that Zdeno Chara has taken a step back. Maybe it's because the Blackhawks skated around him like he was a traffic pylon during that series in the final, even though he was admittedly injured, I think. So I would imagine that Keith has that one in the bag. The Jack Adams Trophy for Coach of the Year. This one, again, should be a little bit more wide open than it actually is. I mean, I, as you know from this podcast and from the blog, have cast my lot for Mike Babcock. Should I have a lot to cast? Obviously, the Jack Adams, not an award for the Professional Hockey Writers Association. But I thought that Babcock did the best job of any coach this year. But there's no denying that Patrick Waugh coming to the Avalanche and the Avalanche doing what they did in the regular season is not a coincidence. What he did for that team, what he did for that goaltender, Semyon Varlamov, for example, I think, you know, was the stuff of awards. So I imagine that the broadcasters, who are the guys that vote on this award, are going to be giving it to Patrick Waugh, not only because he did a hell of a job as head coach, but also because he's a great quote, isn't he? Just a great quote. With all due respect to John Cooper, who also did a very good job, but then again, give me a goalie like Ben Bishop in the year that he had, and I will be a good coach too. Which brings us to the Vezina Trophy, Ben Bishop, Tuukka Rask, Semyon Varlamov, and here's where things could get a little dicey. Here's where things can get kind of interesting, because I know that there is a large Team Rask squad, and there's a large Team Varlamov squad. I don't see Bishop winning because I think Rask would get the majority of the Eastern Conference GM's votes. But I also wonder if Varlamov gets the kind of support that he needs to win the award. I put my name down for Varlamov on this one. I think that the stats were there. I think that you have to take these awards into account based on context, based on what these players were the year before and are now, and what your expectations are for them. And there's no question that Varlamov had the biggest jump in quality between himself and Rask, although you could argue Bishop had the largest jump in quality of all three candidates. The GM's vote on the award, and I've said this from the beginning, and I don't know if this is going to be the case, but it's worth wondering, because I feel like, because it's general managers and because it's guys that are always looking beyond the stats into things like character, whether or not Varlamov's in-season run-in with the law authorities in Denver is going to factor into this at all. It shouldn't. I don't think it should. But you wonder whether or not there's going to be... We're talking about these suits in hockey that keep people out of the Hall of Fame because they didn't smile at them the right way. I mean, we're talking about that level of politicking here, ladies and gentlemen. So I think that the idea that Varlamov's candidacy could be adversely impacted by what happened to him during the season is not out of the realm of possibility. I think statistically, and I think based on expectations and based on play, Varlamov should win the Vezina. Keeping also in mind, for a lot of us, it's not always the Dominik Hasek show. It's not always the Jose Theodore show. The Vezina does serve in some ways as the MVP of goaltending award. Because as my radio partner is wont to say, you could give the MVP a trophy to a goalie every year because they are, by definition, the most valuable player on the ice. But we don't like to do that with the heart. So I think that the Vezina will go to, well, it should go to Varlamov, but I think it ends up going to Rask. So the Norris and the Vezina both have a little bit of an air of mystery. The Masterton, Dominic Moore in a walk, Selke. You know, it's interesting. I don't think Taves wins it. I think Bergeron probably wins it unless there is palpable West Coast guilt. You see, for every action, there is a reaction, ladies and gentlemen. And I experienced this firsthand in covering the Stanley Cup Final in beautiful California. Not only is there East Coast bias, it's palpable, it's real. It's the kind of thing that makes sane people like James Myrtle question the validity of Rob Blake as a Hockey Hall of Famer, because Blake did nothing of consequence, says the man on the East Coast. The East Coast bias is a very real thing, and I'm a party to it, without question. I'm not one of these people that doesn't stay up late to watch the games. I stay up quite late. I have a sleep deprivation. That's why I have stream of conscious when I do the podcast by myself. But I am one of these people that recognizes that if you play on the West Coast, you are not getting the same sort of push from the New York and the Toronto and the Detroit media mafias that you would otherwise. So unless there is the palpable West Coast guilt vote for Anze Kopitar here, I believe that Patrice Bergeron wins the Selke. All due respect to Jonathan Taves. Then you've got the last of the player awards. You've got Nathan McKinnon, Calder Trophy winner Nathan McKinnon. I mean, let's be honest here. Tyler Johnson and Andre Palat of the Tampa Bay Lightning also up for the award. But this is McKinnon in a walk. It's one of those awards that, frankly, should be unanimous, but probably won't be. It's a slam dunk for McKinnon to win this award going away. It's funny. I wonder if we took a look back at who people thought would be the Calder finalists at the beginning of the season. How many Seth Jones votes there were as far as guys that would be there, and how many Jonathan Drouin votes there were before it was decided he'd go back to junior there were as well. So McKinnon walks away with this thing, and rightfully so. And we have two other awards that we have to deal with. The General Manager of the Year award. As you know, the voting has been changed this year, which is a very smart thing for them to do because they've taken a completely ridiculous and nearly invalid award and transformed it into something that has slightly more relevancy, which is that at the conclusion of the second round of the playoffs, that's when the voting happens for these awards, for this GM award. Nick Kostyniko was part of that panel of journalists, both print and broadcast, along with NHL executives and general managers that voted for this award. So it was picked after the second round of the playoffs, which is why you see Mark Bergevin of the Montreal Canadiens having beaten Boston in the second round, Dean Lombardi of the LA Kings having done what they did in the first two rounds, and Bob Murray of the Anaheim Ducks having what they did through two rounds and in the regular season. As far as construction of the team goes, as far as adding pieces, being better than you were in the past, I think Bergevin would win, maybe. I don't know. You got some youngins on the team. Maybe Dean. I mean, Lombardi should obviously win. His team won the cup, and he's built a juggernaut of a champion, and the Gavrik trade turned out to be something of a stroke of genius. But it wouldn't surprise me to see Bergevin win, although I imagine maybe considering the vote was taken after the second round and L.A. did what they did through the first two rounds, it wouldn't surprise me at all to see Dean Lombardi win. And finally, the one that we all are waiting for with bated breath, the one that is the crowning achievement of all NHL awards, that would be, of course, the Lady Bing, ladies and gentlemen. Patrick Marleau, Ryan O'Reilly, Martin Saint-Louis. Now, Marleau is a gentleman, plays very gentlemanly, only 18 penalty minutes, and he has kind eyebrows. Ryan O'Reilly, as has been well documented, joins Butch Goring as the only players to ever receive two or fewer penalty minutes over 80 or more games. Two or fewer, NHL? Okay. Two or fewer. Okay. And then finally, you have Marty Saint-Louis, who quit on his team and demanded a trade to the Rangers. Yeah, those are your finalists. I mean, the fact that Saint-Louis got into the top three is pretty remarkable, right? I mean, the media voted Marty Saint-Louis in as a finalist for the award that goes to the player adjudged to have exhibited the best type of sportsmanship combined with a high standard of playing ability. Sportsmanship award. Telephone went off, sorry. I don't think it's going to be Marleau, and I don't think it's going to be Saint-Louis. I am fairly positive it's going to be Ryan O'Reilly to win this award, even though, once again, he's also a guy who shanghaied his team by signing an offer sheet. Hell, maybe it'll be Marleau. Who knows? The NHL Awards, ladies and gentlemen, are an amazing time. We're chatting it up at Puck Daddy tonight. Do stop by. We will have award-by-award coverage of the NHL Awards, and then after the whole shebang is done, the thing you all really want to see, which is, of course, the Ryan Lambert, five things I loved and five things I hated about the National Hockey League Awards. By the way, in case you were wondering, this just in from the National Hockey League, the order of presentation for the NHL Awards, including the presenters, real briefly, the Ted Lindsay Award, which we skipped over, but it'll be Sid as well, will be presented by Ted Lindsay and Eric Stone Street from Modern Family. The Selke Trophy will be Michael Pekka and David Walton. David Walton, the guy in About a Boy? I'm a little fuzzy. Famous for the NHL, though. Masterton by Rich Peverly and Strombo, who host the show. Calder Trophy, Retta for Parks and Rec, and Luke Robitaille. Guessing we're going to hear some sassy jokes about young boys. Ooh, look at them. They're so cute. Strombo presents the Art Ross to the leading point scorer, a.k.a. Sid. Rocket Richard, Strombo to Ovechkin. King Clancy goes to Andrew Ferentz, and that'll be presented by Adam Graves and Cuba Gooding Jr. And Cuba pulling double duty, he also presents the Mark Messier NHL Leadership Award presented by Bridgestone with none other than Mark Messier. I'm not even going to give that award the time of day. It's the biggest hunk of bullshit award ever. It is the it is a gigantic steaming pile of bullshit. It is like you would need a barge to sail the amount of bullshit that award is. It's a miracle that the winner doesn't get a velvet painting of Mark Messier. That's how much of a vanity project this award is. Or maybe the first place is you get a handshake and a photograph, a photo opportunity with Mark Messier. That would be also in keeping with the vanity project that is this award. The EA NHL 15 cover vote winner will be presented by Doc Emmerich and Eddie Olchek with a special appearance by the hip-hop crew Jabberwockies. And my God, I will give all of the monies to the NHL Awards producers if Doc Emmerich does in fact say the word Jabberwockies during this broadcast multiple times. The Norris Trophy will be presented by Chris Pronger and Flyers fan David Boreanaz of Bones. The Jack Adams, Danny DeKeyser, Tyler Johnson, and Semyon Varlamov present it. Okay. Special recognition of the Stanley Cup champions. They will be introduced by Pia Testado. I know it's Toscano. Who cares? And they will be feted by a performance by Modest Yahoo. Strombo with the Jennings. Lady Bing by Michael Vartan. Remember him from Alias? And also his penis from 1 hour photo. General Manager of the Year, PK Subban, Dustin Brown, and Ryan Getzlaff all get to say nice things about their GMs. The Vezina presented by Colin Hanks, famous for the NHL. And because one award wasn't enough, ladies and gentlemen, Mark Messier will also present the Hart Trophy. Mark Messier, the ubiquitous Jack Nicholson of the NHL Awards this year, shoehorning himself into everything. Here's the Lady Bing, presented by someone who would never win a Lady Bing, Mark Messier. Catering provided by Mark Messier. And now, a special acoustic performance by Mark Messier. It's not that I hate Messier. I love Messier. He's one of our greatest leaders. He took an amazing photo with Gary Coleman once. And it's not as if I'm bitter about him guaranteeing a win over the Devils, because the Devils went on to win three cups and the Rangers are still waiting. It's just that I don't like the Mark Messier Leadership Award at all. I mean, for God's sakes. I'm thinking of a few other players that probably deserve to have their names on an award before Mark Messier. Two of them. One of them he played with. We put it that way. We've been trying to figure out how to get back into Gretzky's good graces for years. And we don't have an award named after him. We got one after Messier. Then he comes out and gives out another one, too. That's great. Nothing better than having a Billy Zane mannequin come, be the face of your league. Right. Lean St. James coming up. Adrian Dater coming up. And with that, let's start the show proper, shall we? We start the Greg Wyshynski Show proper, shall we?
Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Well, again, listen, you're one of my favorite guests. I appreciate you coming on the program.
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
Dude, I know. Listen, I wish I could spend like a full hour or more on the podcast.
Debate hockey, pop culture, and more hockey. Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Apologies to Tom from Southfield, Michigan, who I believe is who called my cell on 1051 ESPN Radio. I can't do a hit at 2:30. I am doing a podcast. Right now, as we speak. The question of the day is, which NHL award would you like to see that isn't there yet? Which category would you like to see the NHL create? PuckDaddyBlog at Yahoo.com, at Wyshynski, at Jeff Merrick, Twitter, hashtag at MVSW. Brian Palmer writes in, the Jeff Merrick Award for the player who only shows up half the time. Ouch, my friend. You know, he's a busy gentleman. He's got many meetings. Sportsnet, I don't know if you know, has the rights to the NHL for at least the next 12 years. Scotty Hockey, the advanced stats star of the game. Ooh. A little Corsi action. Not bad at all. The NHL awards pretty much have everything covered. I'm still a fan of the idea, and Merrick brought this up yesterday in talking about Adam Foote. I'm still a fan of the idea that you do need a defensive defenseman award of some sort to honor those people that get snubbed by the Norris every single year. Like, if there was some award where you could quantify how good a defensive defenseman was and give that guy an award, I'd be all for it. That would free up the Norris to be what it's become, which is the offensive stat award given to a guy who doesn't embarrass himself defensively. Matt Riegler, the Anna Benson Award given to the top five wives who are more noteworthy than their husbands for any reason. Can we rename that the Carrie Underwood Award? Is that possible? Pretty good. The Jaromir Jagr Trophy, says Andrew McCreary, to the best gambler and best hair. Section 328. The Chris Neal Award for being the biggest pain in the ass without getting suspended. The Towing the Line Award. I love it. Patrick Clark, the Mike Sillinger Memorial Franken Jersey Award to the guy who plays for the most teams in one season. Andrew Armstrong, the No Back Check Award goes to the highest scoring Russian. Oh, now that's just mean. Extraordinarily mean, sir. Have you no decency? One thing before Helene hops on, by the way, to talk a little Red Wings action and Hall of Fame action about Scotty Hartnell, I wanted to mention. Oh, she's there? I'll bring up Hartnell later. Joining us now on the line is a writer for the Detroit Free Press, who I believe was also on the same enlightening Hall of Fame conference call as I was yesterday. Helene St. James joins us here on the Merrick versus Wyshynski podcast. Hello. Welcome back.
Hello. Thank you.
No problem. That was a scintillating Hall of Fame conference call yesterday, wasn't it?
You know, I felt a little bad. I was trying to think of just a question to throw at Peter Forsberg because I don't think he got any. It was,
kind
of odd how few people there were on there, I thought. And, but at least, you know, Dominic certainly had some interest from Detroit for his pretty stellar career.
Oh, and he was great too. If you haven't read the coverage of that call, I mean, his comments about almost quitting the NHL back when he was with Chicago, then putting over that 2002 Red Wings team, based the catalyst was your question about it. I didn't realize until you brought it up. So that's 7 Hall of Famers from that team and 3 more probably on the way in Datsyuk, Fedorov, and Lidstrom, yeah?
Yeah, Lidstrom for sure. I mean, he's got to be first ballot next year. Fedorov's also eligible next year. I don't know if he'll be first ballot. He should certainly be in. And then fingers crossed, not before 2020, 3 years after he plays out his current deal. Pavel Datsyuk, who was just a very young little rookie who Brett Hull, of all people, loved playing with. So, yeah, it's plus, of course, Scotty Bowman, Mike Ilitch, Jimmy Devolano. So, yeah, that 2002 team is just, you know, it did also have a payroll of approximately $90 billion. But you know, let's not get caught up in that.
It was a different time, and I'm sure if it was today, all those guys would be more than happy to take discounts to play with each other on that Detroit team. You know, it's funny. I don't want to read too much into the election of Pavel Bure to the Hall of Fame recently, because I feel like that was one of the first times we saw a guy who didn't necessarily have the career stats or the career longevity, but did have the cultural impact on the game thing going for him. And I always thought if Bure gets in, then Fedorov gets in. If Bure gets in, then Lindros gets in. But I don't know for sure. You seem a little iffy, more iffy on Fedorov than I thought you'd be.
No, I mean, I think he'll get in. I don't know if he'll be a first ballot, you know, the way Lidstrom for sure deserved to be, and Dominik Hasek and such, and Steve Yzerman. I think he certainly deserves to be in, but there are quite a few guys who don't get in the first. I don't think Shanahan didn't get in the first time around, right? So, you know, I mean, there's always some very tough decisions and some players that get left out every year. So I just don't know. Plus, I'm not sure who else is eligible next season, and it's 4 players maximum, right? So,
right.
To me, I mean, but Nicholas Lidstrom has to be, you know, a slam dunk, one of them. So,
oh yeah, for sure. As far as Hasek goes, what kind of comparisons, contrasts, maybe their legacies, what kind of comparisons do you draw or differences do you draw between what Mike Vernon, Dominik Hasek, and Chris Osgood gave the Red Wings during that run?
Well, Hasek's in such a class of by himself, right? I mean, he was a rare goaltender who could make a difference all by himself, and, you know, you saw how the impact he had in Buffalo, and then, you know, I mean, Wings, you know, had been a little bit frustrated in the years leading up to 01-02, and he just gave them that extra power they needed. I absolutely loved covering the guy. I was talking to Ken Holland yesterday and just reminiscing about how part of the charm of Hasek was just how completely honest he was, assessing himself, assessing an opponent. I remember him, and I hope there's nobody, no fans of the Blue Jackets listening in right now, because I remember him shouting out the Blue Jackets at some game and he's saying, well, you know, they weren't very good. And it wasn't trash talking the Blue Jackets. They just weren't having a very good season. You know, but just that complete honesty, instead of a goalie or a player saying, well, the other team, give them credit, they played 60 minutes. He was just, you know, and the same thing when things soured for him in Detroit, you know, he would say, I wasn't very good and I shouldn't be playing. And, you know, everybody knows both 3-4 what happened. You know, he declined his salary because he had so many going and so much problems with groin. He was just, he was a really stand-up guy to cover, and feel very fortunate. And I got to go to the Czech Republic in the summer of 2002 and follow the cup around. This was back when our newspaper industry had money. so, you know, these days I'm not sure I would get to travel to Toronto if they won the cup, but, you know, and follow him around to see how incredibly special he was treated in the Czech Republic. It was a really neat experience being able to cover him.
No, we'd have to rely on YouTube videos, the Hockey Hall of Fame Twitter feed, and anybody who happened to bring a camera to that event is how we would have to cover it today, unfortunately. As far as Modano goes, I mean, talk about his legacy as a local product making the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he's obviously most of all and above all associated with the Minnesota Dallas franchise. But, you know, he was, you know, there's an arena named after him in Westland. You know, he always enjoyed coming here and playing. He told me once Joe Louis Arena is one of his favorite arenas to play in just because of the atmosphere. And, you know, it was just really, really unfortunate how things unwrapped for his final season in the NHL. He got that awful wrist injury, courtesy of Archie Umberger, actually, I believe, a guy who's been in the news lately, right around Thanksgiving, missed 41 games. It's tough for 40-year-olds to come back in March and pick up the speed and ended up as a healthy scratch in the playoffs. You know, but I think it was very unfortunate how things turned out, but in, every time I've talked to him, I've gotten the impression that, you know, he really cherished being able to play here even for what turned out to be half a season. And just of all the places for him to have to go when Dallas wasn't interested in the 21st season, Detroit really was the ideal place for him.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Moving on to the Red Wings now. First off, we had Bill Peters on the show yesterday, and I have to admit that when I was poking my nose around in L.A., during the Cup final, talking to some people, a lot of people were surprised that Bill Peters got as much play as he did. It wasn't as if he was Todd McClellan. It wasn't as if anybody saw him as sort of the next in line for Babcock or any of that thing. There were a lot of people that were really surprised he was sort of the flavor of the month for a lot of these teams and then winds up getting the job in Carolina. Were you at all surprised by his candidacy for these jobs, or is that just by virtue of working for Mike Babcock and the Red Wings, you're going to get that kind of play?
Well, you know, Bill Peters had good success in the AHL level before coming to Detroit. I think also every now and then you'll see, I mean, God knows the NHL recycles the same coaches over and over, but every now and then you'll see a movement kind of like, hey, let's get some fresh faces in. I think he was ideal for that reason. Also, let's be honest, he probably is going to cost you a little bit less than somebody who has more experience, but I think it's a great fit for him. He's really, really smart. He did a lot for Detroit's penalty killing. And this season, God knows he was challenged with all the injuries they had and continuing to figure out ways for them to be good on the penalty kill. I mean, they didn't have Datsyuk or Söderberg, two of their top go-to guys in that area. So I think it's a great hire. It'll be interesting to see, you know, because assistants usually are the buffers between the head coach and the players. So how does he kind of take a step back? Or he was a great communicator with the players. The players in Detroit all enjoyed talking to him. I know that. So it'll be interesting to see. But I think it's a great hire for Carolina.
Yeah, and did he also coach the defense in Detroit as well?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, so is that going to impact them? Because, I mean, that was a group that I think played a little bit head above water for a lot of us, at least what we saw on paper last year.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the people they've lost in recent years, and they're so much younger in defense. And then, you know, in the playoffs, they didn't have Jonathan Erickson, one of their top shutdown guys either. So the defense definitely played better. And it was interesting, at the start of the season, I was talking to Mike Babcock about, you know, how do you build on the success they had in 2012-13. He said, well, it really, for me, it hinges on the growth of our young guys. And, you know, Brendan Smith, I think Söderberg, summed him up so well in the 2013 playoffs that he creates a lot for both sides. You know, but Smith really, to me, had a much better post-Olympic stretch. When he got paired with Nicholas Cronwall, it really benefited him to play with a veteran. That's why I think the key for the Wings this offseason is find a top four guy to add to your defensive core, and they're going to be that much better. And then, fingers crossed, they stay healthy this time around.
All right, what are they going to end up doing with Daniel Alfredsson? That's what everybody wants to know.
Well, he's told them he wants to play another season. There's a little bit of concern about his back, you know, which obviously with a 41-year-old, you kind of have to recognize that's a red flag. But I think if they can get him to agree to a low enough base salary and then make a lot of it, you know, bonuses that he can earn a good salary bonus-wise, that would be ideal. He was just a great addition for them last season. Really, if you look at his numbers, I think overachieved, considering that a lot of times he was playing on the third line with guys who weren't exactly great at getting him the puck. And just, I don't think you can overemphasize the leadership he brought in the locker room, especially when Henrik Söderberg, their captain, was missed out half the season. Pavel Datsyuk was out half the season. He's a lot like Nicklas Lidström, and just consummate professional, extremely easygoing, and just a great guy for them to have around. So I think they'd love to see that work out and him come back for another season.
So Darren Drager did a Darren Drager-y thing today and was talking about Jerome Iginla and the Boston Bruins and kind of said if things don't work out there contractually for Iginla, that he expects the Detroit Red Wings to be in the mix for Iginla. Could you see something like that happening?
Yeah, you know, I actually wrote that 2 weeks ago that they're for sure going to, because Boston has cap issues. I don't know how, unless they trade somebody, they're not going to be able to re-sign all their RFAs and Iginla unless he takes, you know, $20 in base salary. So, you know, and 2 years ago when he was leaving Calgary, Detroit reportedly wasn't one of his destinations. Well, it didn't work out in Pittsburgh, didn't work out in Boston. If I'm him, I got to think, wow, would it be fun to play next to Pavel Datsyuk, right? He's a right-handed shot, which Detroit is after. So I think they kind of got to get sorted out by the end of this week, what's up with Alfredson. I don't see them adding a defenseman, a quality defenseman, Daniel Alfredson and Jerome Iginla, but I think they're very interested. And Iginla, I looked at his stats. I mean, he's going on 37. He's missed something like 8 games since he turned 30. Just incredibly durable guy. So, yeah, I would think, or for sure, depending on what happens with Alfredson, Red Wings are going to be very interested in Jerome Iginla.
Yeah, played more this season or last season with Boston time of ice on average than he did with Pittsburgh, and I think was better for it without question, really meshing with Lucic and Krejci in the top line. Two more questions for you, ma'am, and thanks for joining us today on the show. First off, Babcock up for Coach of the Year tonight. I cast my ring in his favor. I thought he did the best job of any coach this year. I have a feeling that the broadcasters are going to hand it to Patrick Waugh, but do you think Babs deserves Jack Adams this year?
I do. I mean, I can see the argument for Patrick Waugh, too, being a rookie coach, and I don't think anybody expected Colorado to do as well as they did. But Detroit, I mean, the amount of people he had out, and to me it was just fascinating to watch Mike this year because he's, you know, team veteran all the way until all of a sudden this year. It was like he just fell in love with the young guys and played them even after they got healthier veterans back around March and such. I mean, Thomas Yurko is 21 years old. He kept putting him out on the ice, kept putting him out on the power play. Tatar, Shahan, you know, I mean, Nyquist kind of stole the show with all his goal scoring, but I love watching Shahan play. If he can develop his offense a little bit, he's just such a responsible two-way guy. And he was on the ice against Krejci a lot in the playoffs. Didn't have a point, but, you know, Krejci didn't exactly light it up against Detroit either. So I think Shahan's a great story. And Mike played them a lot and showed confidence in them, which, you know, it wasn't his modus operandi in previous years. So, yeah. And, you know, Patrick Roy had, I think they have a pretty good goalie out in Colorado that they relied on quite a bit. Jimmy Howard had a very up and, I'm not taking anything away from Jimmy Howard, but he had a very rough first half, especially. And Gustafsson, the Wings are bringing him back only for 1 year. They like him a lot, but he's also reliably injured for some stretches every single season. So Mike Babcock did what he did without ever getting sustained great goaltending. So, yeah, I don't think Mike's going to win either, but to me, he'd have been the best choice.
Yeah, I guess it all depends on how you feel about what impact Waugh had on Varlamov. You know, I think both he and Francois Allaire probably combined their forces to make that kid a better goalie than he's been. But I essentially agree with you, though. Like, if you're not going to – if that's sort of a what-if factor, if you're just going to go based on what happened in the season, I mean, there's no question they had better goaltending than Detroit had and many, many fewer injuries. I mean, God, the most indelible vision from 24/7 that I replay in my head over and over again is Babcock in front of that whiteboard erasing names and writing names and figuring out who the hell these kids are that are playing on his team now and all that stuff. So you're completely right. And I guess finally – your take on Uruguay and Italy today that finished up right before the podcast.
Oh, I love to see. You know, I mean, no disrespect to Uruguay, but I got to think Italy was heavily favored, right? So just, to me, Italy dives a little bit too much for me to ever be a fan of theirs. So no tears shed here that Italy is out and England is out and Spain is out. I think it's been just a fantastic World Cup to watch so far. Lots of exciting matches, right? Who did Switzerland beat? Did Uruguay or no, it must have been Paraguay in one of their early round matches too. I think it's
Ecuador.
Yeah, Ecuador. You're right. I'm sorry, it was Ecuador. It's just been such an exciting World Cup. I've watched nearly every minute of every match, including Iran and Nigeria, which is, you know, who do you root for there? Not exactly two nations, right?
It's what's like, the
you tally up who has the least human rights violations?
What
kidnapped girls the least? I don't know, but.
I know here in D.C. it's been real big as far as the ratings, as far as everybody crowding around and checking out stuff at bars. What's it been like out in Detroit, out your way? Have people been going nuts about it as far as the local impact of the World Cup?
Oh, yeah. You know, but it's a popular game around here, and especially, you know, the timing of it is very well, right, because there's nothing, I mean, baseball is going on, but otherwise it's quiet in all the other sports, so... I think, you know, it's been hugely popular here as well.
Cool. Very good. All right. Thank you so much for joining us, Lean, and we will catch up with you down the line. You have the draft this year, or, you know, Detroit usually not exactly a high picking team in the draft. You have the draft this year?
No, but you know what? They picked 15th, which is the highest they've picked, I believe since 91 when they picked a certain Martin LaPointe 10th overall. So yeah, this is very high for them to be at 15th, and, you know, they're very excited about it. They're much more committed now, thanks to the salary cap, to improving from within and just seeing this season what an impact draft picks or their own prospects can have on the game. So, yeah, I'm absolutely going to be there.
Awesome. Very good. Thanks for joining us on the show today.
My pleasure.
Take care. Lean St. James and the Detroit Free Press dropping knowledge about the Red Wings for you. Red Wings, interesting team. I mean, you know, they're in that sort of – well, it's just what they do, right? I mean, there's an element of veterans on this team. There's a bunch of kids coming up. There is always the possibility that there could be a run made. There's always the possibility they'll play to the bubble. Who really knows? You look at their cap situation right now, and again, this is a team that carries some significant salary in a couple of positions, but overall. The Wings have, according to CapGeek right now, with 17 players signed, $18.6 million under the cap, with DeKaiser, Sheehan, and Thomas Tatar, your restricted free agents there. So, and already Samuelson and Bertuzzi not coming back for this team. So it's clear that they have the decks cleared for the acquisition of a top-line defenseman. But who knows who that could be and who knows who's available. Everybody wants one. But Detroit probably has the assets and the finances to try to make that happen. They, of course, were in as far as they could go on Ryan Suter before he decided to head to Minnesota with his buddy Zach. And you imagine Detroit, if they have any kind of beat on a top defenseman, is going to try to make that thing happen. But that, again, like I said to Helene, you know, that defense under Bill Peters last year definitely played a lot better than many of us thought it would. And clearly Erickson is in his prime right now. Cronwall's great. Good stuff from Smith. DeKaiser looked great. A little bit better season from Jimmy Howard, and all of a sudden that whole thing could be solidified again. So good stuff from her. And I know that we had a lot of people that follow the Wings that are following us on Twitter and checking out that interview. So hopefully we were able to drop some knowledge. The Hartnell thing I wanted to mention was just the idea that, you know, in his availability yesterday, it became quite clear what had happened. You know, both Ron Hextall and Jarmo Kekäläinen had kind of given their own spins on the story. Jarmo not really getting into details on why he left, but more why he chose Columbus, which is the opportunity to win and to play on a team where he thinks that his skill set fits better than maybe it does in Philly. And Hextall making the argument that it was a business decision based on the length of contract, some slight cap savings, and also speed was the other thing, too, with Umberger bringing more of it to the team than Hartnell did. But Hartnell made it pretty clear in his availability. He was forced out, man. He had just the ink wasn't even dry on this contract with a no-move clause. And his GM calls up his agent and basically says, hey, we're getting these sniffs about Hartnell, which is horseshit. Like, they're obviously shopping him if the idea is that they're going to try to if he doesn't fit their plans. It's not as if people are dialing up saying, hey, is Hartnell, hey, is the guy who just signed a six-year contract with a no-move clause, is he available? Yes. I'm sure they were getting a multitude of calls about him. He wasn't being shopped, Ron Hextall. So he gets forced out. I mean, basically just forced out. The yet another Flyer joining Carter, joining Richards, joining Van Riemsdyk, and now Hartnell, joining Bryzgalov. All these guys sign these long-term deals in Philly and get dicked over. And I asked Hartnell about that. I said, you know, at some point, don't players kind of get a little restant? Don't they get a little bit worried about long-term contract? They're actually signing their walking papers in Philadelphia. And he kind of brushed it off. He kind of ran around the question. And that's fine. I mean, what's done is done. In Hartnell's case, he kind of has cover because he can blame it on Hextall, who, by the way, he referred to as Hextall. You know, I've been on many a conference call and done many an interview with people where they refer to their general manager as George or Lou or Mr. Lamarillo or Glenn. Not a lot of Hextalls. Very informal. Very a little agitated. I just think at some point, you know, what player is going to go long-term in Philly now? It's the kiss of death. They can't be trusted. And I was asked about that this morning. Like, why would anybody go long-term in Philly or New York? Well, the difference is that in Philly, you end up getting traded to Columbus. In New York, you end up getting $50 million. That's the difference. One is a buyout and one is a trade when the team realizes they may have made a mistake. Joining us now on the line is the man who makes no mistakes. He is Adrian Dater of the Denver Post and Bleacher Report, and he joins us now on the Merrick vs. Rudinsky podcast from beautiful Las Vegas. How are you, Adrian?
I'm good. I have a sweeping view of the strip here from my all-suite room at the Rio, and I'm up $150.
Did you get I was going to say, here, so man. You went downstairs last night, you rolled them bones, and you did quite well. What game did you win on?
I won $25 on, I think, a two pair on video poker. That's all I play. I'm not much of a gambler. As you know, the Dater jinx is pretty strong and doesn't apply to gambling, but it did last night. It's gone. And then I just threw in another $5 hand and up popped four queens. So there you go.
Whoa.
That was $150. So I'll take it. I'll take it for sure.
Here's my question. Here's my question for you. I mean, you and I have a lot in common, obviously. We're both cynics. I'm someone who doesn't trust video poker or video gaming machines because I feel like the fix is in. I feel like for whatever reason, I can control the elements in a game of blackjack more than I can by pressing a button on a video poker machine. How do you get past your Luddite distrust of technology to play poker?
It's just that I'm so lazy and I'm not good with anything other than just punching a button, Greg. That's it. I can't do any more thinking than that when I'm in Vegas. I usually have too much shrimp and cheap wine in me or something to think much. I just want to punch that blinking button and see what pops up. Yes, I do believe the fix is in as well. I mean, there's a reason why these casinos are really big and beautiful. They weren't built by guys who, you know, lost a lot of money. So they were made by people who won money. And the house took more than its share to build these things. So, no, I'm ahead, man. I came into the it was at the Wynn when I did it, and you know, Steve Wynn. I'm sorry, man, but I'm up actually $175 on you. So, Steve,
nice.
You may need to take out a loan to make up the difference there. But yeah, it's Dater, man. Dater rules here in Vegas.
Dater rules in Vegas, ladies and gentlemen. All right, listen. So yesterday was a busy day. Peter Forsberg makes the Hall of Fame on a first ballot. Surprised at all that he was a first ballot Hall of Famer?
No, not at all. I mean, come on. Fopa was, you know, he had that shortened career and, you know, 700 games, not a lot, but 1.25 points per game. That's what puts you in, plus the two cups, plus the gold medals. The Swedish postage stamp goal in 94 and Lillehammer. Pretty much a no-brainer. I mean, everybody who saw Peter Forsberg play knows what a just breathtaking player he was. Just couldn't get over the damn foot injuries for, you know, 4 years or however that long that thing went on, that dragged on. So, no. He's just, you know, I said it before. He was the best player I covered in, you know, as a, that I saw in the in their prime. I saw Gretzky, obviously, but he wasn't in his prime. Peter was, to me, the most talented and complete player I ever saw, and just the guy who always made my somehow internal, you know, self go woo, you know, when I saw something.
Oh yeah,
I saw that a lot.
He's magic. Yeah. Magical player, that unique combination of size and skill. I mean, it's just a ridiculous stick handler.
He did try to play too much player. Like a power forward, though, right? I mean, he did shorten his career by trying to play like he was Tony Twist too a lot. It was too bad because it did hurt him. He played in the wrong era. I think the sad thing about Peter Forsberg, when it's all said and done, is he played in the wrong era for him. He played in a first of all, the dead puck era. He played in an era where defensemen could just hack and whack and ride him like a bull all the time. And I don't know how many times I saw him just get mugged as a player with the Avs. And just you know, the refs back then, the one referee system that just, hey, play on, man. Be tough. Take your lumps. Quit whining. You know, the guys would just be sitting on top of Forsberg at the other end of the ice. And the man would just be like, tackle him and just sit on him still. And everybody would be screaming, and the ref would just – I really think that Forsberg had some bias against him too. I think they thought – I can't prove this, but I think that referees are a little bit biased against him. The Swede, he's not one of our boys. You know, play tough. Let the Canadian D-man ride you like a bull and take it, you know, and like it and just be tough and take it.
Oh, man.
So, I really do.
You're trafficking in Olympic referee conspiracy theories now. Oh, we don't have a Swedish guy in this game. It's two Canadians. Oh no, the fix is in.
I'm talking the era of the mid '90s though. That's what I think was the case more than it is today. But that's what I think.
But you were also dealing, I think, with a lot of referees that were purely incompetent and that were there because of seniority, like Don Kowalski. But anyways, the thing about Forsberg that for me is interesting is, and I said this to Helene St. James right before you hopped on, like when Pavel Bure got in, I really felt that was going to be a moment that opened the doors for some other kinds of players. And I almost feel like Forsberg's in the same boat. Like Forsberg is a guy who gets in. Yeah, he's got statistic achievement, but a lot of the real wow factor numbers for him are points per game, assists per game, like the sort of the prorated stuff, let's call it. And I feel like that's the argument for Eric Lindros, is the prorated stuff. It's what his points per game average, what he did in his career before the injuries really took him out. Do you think that Forsberg getting in what was in the minds of a lot of people a truncated career because of injuries opens the door for Lindros, or do you think Lindros just isn't a Hall of Famer?
I think Lindros will get in. I think he was a unique player for his time, too. Probably the player you most compare to Forsberg in many ways, the power forward who had skill. He didn't have the winning behind him, though. I mean, he had winning teams. He went to the Cup Finals one year with Philly. Never won a Cup. I don't know if that hurts him too much to not get in. Probably not. Barry didn't win one either. I think he's going to get in based on his pure numbers, and it's going to be close. So he is a tweener guy, but based on some other guys that have been in the Hall, I mean, I think you got to get Eric Lindros in there too. He did have such a real flame out to his career though that it does hurt, I think, too much that he just was so bad the last few years he played. Not saying he was bad always when he was on the ice, but he was so injury riddled that he just couldn't play like he ever could. And I think it's going to be tough, but I think he'll get in.
Yeah, I think so too. I think you're right. As far as the NHL awards tonight, which you're out there to cover, I mean, we all assume, well, McKinnon's a lock.
Yeah.
We all assume that Waugh wins the Jack Adams over Babcock and Cooper. The one that's kind of a mystery, I think, as far as where your guys are involved, is the Varlamov versus Rask versus Bishop Vezina trophy. Where do you see that vote going tonight?
Yeah, I think Varlamov has only got like a 10 or 15% chance. I think it's going to be Rask.
Oh, really? Wow.
I do. Okay. I just think that, you know, the Boston, the Eastern bias is going to kick in. And and win over those poor Western guys that don't get any credit and publicity. No, I think that he will. I just, you know, and Bishop, though, I mean, Bishop could win, too. I think it's like, I would put it like 60% Brask, 30 Bishop, 10 Varlamov. Just don't see it for Varley on that. I don't think he had quite the eye-popping numbers that made him just everybody jump enough to go over Rask, who played on a bigger team and a better team and more decorated team. You know, and as far as the Lady Bing, who cares? I don't know. I think Ryan O'Reilly has a shot at that. But, Varlamov, no, it's not going to happen for him. He needed that a little extra thing. He needed, 10, 12 shutouts or something, or something really eye-popping. Great numbers, but not just wow numbers. So I think wow wins the Jack Adams for sure, although, I do think there's going to be some sentiment for John Cooper in there. Not going to be a slam dunk for Patrick, but I think he wins. I'll put it about 85% for him.
Interesting. And as far as the Avs themselves go, there's obviously a lot of talk about this team right now, talk about what to do with Ryan O'Reilly's contract, talk about Paul Stastny. Let's start with Stastny first. From what you've heard from Sakic and company on this score, what do you think is going to happen with Stastny this offseason?
I think what's going on is this. I think he's almost certainly going to listen to some offers starting tomorrow, Stastny and his agent. They're going to see what's out there, gauge the interest level of certain teams, and they're going to do that, and then I think they're going to go back to the Avs and say, all right, what we think we're going to get. Can you guys come anywhere close, or what? And the Avs are going to give them an answer on that, but if it's anything more than $6 million a year that Stastny can make on the open market, I don't think the Avs are going to go there at all.
A Matt Duchene cap is what you're saying?
I do believe that's true. The structure of this team, they use that word a lot here, is that we have our structure, and we're paying Matt $6 million, so if you want to be with us, you got to get in that ballpark between $5 million and $6 million if you're a special player. The trouble for the Avs is there's going to be teams that have holes to fill at center are going to have cap room and say, hey, Paul, come on, we'll give you 6.5 for seven. He may get seven. I mean, wow. Who knows? So if that's the case, I think he's out of here. Could the Avs trade his rights for a week to some team and get a draft pick? I suppose they could, but I don't – the thing is the Avs – want him back. The thing, it just boggles me a little bit, is that they want him back. They publicly express that they want him back. But yet, they're not, it doesn't seem like they're working very hard to get him back. Mm-hmm. So they're just waiting around to hear from him what he gets on the open market. That's a really dangerous thing when you get sweet talked by another team. It's really easy to get swept off your feet.
Yeah, but as much as they need him back and they want him back, I mean, isn't there something to be said for him wanting to stay in a good situation? I mean, there's no question that's a good situation for him.
I know,
he might have to just take the discount, right?
Well, I'm sure the Avs would go to like 5.5, 5.75 for him on a long-term deal or something, a 4 or 5 year deal maybe. I mean, I don't know if they want to go 5 years with him, but I'm sure they might. And 5 to 5.5, that's pretty good money. That's probably not going to be that big a hometown discount on what he's going to make on the over. I just can't see a team giving him $7 million for 5 years or something. That's a dumb contract for Paul Stastny. And he's playing on a line that's just going to be tailor-made for points for him and winning. Gabe Landeskog and Nathan MacKinnon will be his line mates here. That's two rookie of the years in the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, what more of a line would you want to be on as a center, really?
Maybe you want a brunette. I mean, there's a couple blondes there. Maybe you're angling to play with a brunette. It's possible.
Yeah, I know it. So, he's got a good situation here, and if he does leave for, let's say, $500,000 more per year somewhere, well, then we're gonna, really gonna find out a little bit more about what Paul Stastny really is all about, maybe.
Yeah, and we'll. We'll find out. He's a second line center making $7 million. Probably what
yeah.
we'll find out.
Yeah.
Finally, I feel like we're cheating on our good friend Jeff Merrick here by having a substantive conversation about Ryan O'Reilly without him on the podcast. But your thoughts on O'Reilly, your thoughts on where this whole thing ends up. I've written that I just feel like there's way too much water under the bridge right now to believe he's going to be anywhere but out of Denver within 2 years. What's your take?
I kind of agree. I mean, it's so weird, man. It's such a weird situation with Ryan O'Reilly. I mean, I couldn't help but just be strangely weirded out by talking to him yesterday. Like, I was standing there talking to Ryan O'Reilly, and he's just so laid back and just casual about this whole thing, you know, and nothing seems to bother him at all about anything, and yet, you know, he wants to stay in Colorado. He loves Colorado, he says, and yet everything from that camp, from them and Pat Morris, is no, it's got to be top dollar, and it just based on the history of the teams, in the player, it just seems like, yeah, they're going to play him. They may play him the whole year and just do it all again next year and then trade him, or not. I think what's going to happen is they're always going to have their ear open for some big offer from Ryan O'Reilly in the next 2 years. Mm-hmm. And eventually, because I don't think it's going to work out for a long-term deal, they're going to have to take one of them. The only question is when, within the next 2 years. That just seems to be what I agree with you on that. It's a shame because I really do think they're losing out on a great player, but
oh, yeah.
Also a strangely another situation where maybe you're talking about a guy who's just sort of all when it's all said and done, it's about him and his salary, and I don't know if you can make that argument that hey, maybe you don't want those guys long term, you know, I don't know, it's a strange situation. I've had a hard time figuring this thing out from the get-go.
Well, he's also got a bit of the old crazy hockey dad thing going on, too, which is an X factor in all this stuff. You never know how that's going to shake out either. But anyways, all right,
well,
hey, listen,
been good. Yeah.
Enjoy the desert, enjoy Vegas. Are you going to be at the draft as well?
The only way you're going to see me at the draft is if there's a ghost of me somehow or something. I will be covering that event by phone, it looks like.
The Listen.
Nathan MacKinnon pick for us this year, number 23. The boss man says, stay home, let's save a few pennies and cover it over the phone. So,
look, the bottom line is this. It means
that
you
have, does exist for
the
us.
Bottom line, the bottom line is that you. It means that the Avalanche had a good season. And that means you don't have to go to the draft and second pick first overall. And it was a really good season because they had like a billion people up for awards, so you got to go to Vegas instead.
I don't
understand what the complaint is here. You don't have to go to Philadelphia, and you get to go to Las Vegas.
Well, I love Philly, first of all, so I'll skip that one, Daisy Dodd. But, of course, what will happen, of course, is they have to make some gigantic trade. They'll trade O'Reilly at the draft. Something blow up with Stastny, maybe. And I'll be scrambling trying to get people on a phone instead of being there as live first. The Dater jinx will prevail again in Philly, I bet.
It's not as if they made the Eric Johnson trade at 2 a.m. I mean, it's not as if they've ever inconvenienced anybody before.
All right, God, don't bring that one up.
All right, AD, thanks for joining us, man. We'll talk to you down the line.
Greg, thanks a lot for having me.
Oh, hey, what's your podcast again, so people can give it a listen?
Oh yeah, thanks. It's Hockey Talk with Adrian Dater. We have some fun on there. Greg, I'd like to have you back on at some point for that.
Certainly.
It's on iTunes, Hockey Talk with Adrian Dater. Thanks for the plug.
There it is. Adrian Dater, ladies and gentlemen. He's the host of Hockey Talk with Adrian Dater, as you may have heard. It's a podcast. Everybody occasionally asks me and Merrick, like, what podcasts we listen to. Dater's is pretty good. Like, Dater's is a good sort of conversational one in the vein of this podcast when we have guests on and you know, then there's always your puck podcasts and everybody else. Face Off Hockey Show, our boys there. And then there's like all those little tiny podcasts that all the SB Nation guys have. They're like Broad Street Hockeys and all that other stuff too. So, yeah, there's always good stuff. You just got to search it out and whatever. Speaking of searching it out and speaking of Broad Street Hockey, 2014 NHL Draft Party, 21 and over. Sorry, youngins.
If you're like 20 in like 10 months, we'll see what we can do. Thursday, June 26th, 8 p.m., McGillin's Old Ale House, 1310 Drury Street, between Chestnut and Samson, off 13th, Center City, Philadelphia. It's me and Merrick and Leahy and Harrison, plus Travis and Kurt and Charlie and Albert and the Broad Street Hockey Crew. $3 margaritas at a pub. I mean, good Lord, if anyone could ever make a top-shelf margarita for $3, it would be an Irish pub. $2.50 PBR pitchers, $7 Bud Light pitchers, and just because we love you, $4 Fireball shots. So buy me one. So the draft party's Thursday. Hope to see you all out there. I know a lot of you are making plans to head to it the day before the draft, which will be a lot of fun, and we'll be happy to see you. Couple of emails real quick before we head out here. Peter P., new award, the Ray Shiro GM of last year award. Looking back at the continued outcomes of the moves made the year before, I don't think Shiro would win this year. A very, very good point. Paul Vogel, the Hologram Bill Masterton Award. The only award that should be awarded is the Hologram Bill Masterton Award for Best Chirp of the Year. The winner this year is clearly Duncan Keith for Wakey Wakey. Oof, a very good point. Ryan Medina. The Rod Langway Award for Defenseman. That is an award that I believe James Myrtle has been lobbying for some time. You know the people who actually play defense. The NHL has no love for those guys. Random Penguin coach Dan Disko. You're fired, Bylsma. Lambert with the line of the week, by the way, by mentioning that Bylsma, that Bylsma is, is the best candidate for the job that's open right now. Mike Barber, I think I wrote this in last year, but I still want to see the Gordie Howe Award for the Wayne Simmonses of the world that post a relatively large amount of goals, assists, and fights in a given year, if only because I think Gordie Howe needs an award named after him. Well, Mike, there's no room for the Gordie Howe Award, my friend. I mean, there's all these Mark Messier awards that need to be handed out. I know. And finally, come on, email. Why doesn't email want to work now? Ah, there we go. Finally, Martin Waldman writes into the QOD today for the NHL award we most like to see. The E5 award for the hockey writer whose terrible prognostications make even Eklund look positively Nostradamus-like by comparison. You know, it's funny. I don't know if you saw this back and forth with me and Royal Half on Twitter. Eklund was at the NHL, was at the Stanley Cup final, and he was on the ice when the Kings won, and in fact was wearing Google Glass to record all of the happenings, which I thought was kind of a neat thing to be doing that. So yeah, I mean, I don't know if anybody actually saw it, or if it turned out all right, if it was for his own edification, if he just screens it in his, you know, basement dwelling to himself. I don't know what he did with the footage, but it happened, and he was there. So there's that. Hall of Fame, by the way, we were one off. I mean, I thought that Forsberg without question, Hasek without question, Madonna without question. Blake was a little bit of a surprise. I know there's a lot of people out there that are like, why not Recchi over Blake? Well, Blake's got the trophy at least. I mean, Recchi to me, and someone made this comparison the other day too, and I think it's a fair one. Even though Blake had a bit of mercenary in him, playing in a couple of different spots, I mean, Recchi was a bit of a journeyman, and bouncing back and forth between teams and that sort of thing. And maybe if he had played all the way through with one team, he'd be viewed as Bernie Federico or something like that, and it might be in already. And I'm willing to accept that as a possibility. But I think overall, Blake, if you're going to put him in the Hall of Fame, I'm fine with getting him in before Recchi, as long as Recchi gets in. And if we're going to go by stats, of course, as long as Dave Andrechuk gets in too. But, you know, the class of 2014 is very solid. The class of 2015 is going to include people like Chris Pronger. It's one of those classes coming up where you simply aren't sure whether it's going to be the year where a guy like Lindros has a chance. I mean, now we're getting into some territory here where we are going to see some players coming up in a few years that seem like they're slam dunks, you know? So now all of a sudden you're wondering about Lindros and Roenick and when they get their turn. But hey, Blake waited a year. I'm sure others will wait a year too, or two or three, and eventually get in. I said this this morning to somebody, like, the more you talk about Lindros as a candidate, and the conversations about his candidacy will continue without question, the more likely it is that he gets in. I really believe that if it wasn't for the complete fervor, for the complete ongoing debates and outcry every single year about Pat Burns being left off the ballot, and being excluded from enshrinement in the Hall of Fame, even when he was sick, I don't think that there would necessarily have been an outcry to get him in. But I think the fact that people every single year were pushing the envelope and saying this is an injustice, this guy belongs in, really made it almost force the hand of the selection committee to eventually put him in. Anyways, that is it for today's podcast, a jam-packed one indeed. Thanks to Lean St. James. Thanks to Andrea Dater for joining us. Here's how the next couple days work, okay? Show tomorrow, me and Merrick. Tonight, NHL Awards, chatting on Puck Daddy, award by award posts, including vote totals, and then the big wrap-up from Lambert at the end of the night or tomorrow morning, depending on when we post it. Jen is on site. She'll have a lot of stuff from the awards. Her Q&A, by the way. Some people read it and didn't quite get it. It's supposed to feel cringy. Like, it's supposed to feel a little bit awkward. That's the whole point of it. Like, she kept in the awkward laughter of the athletes and things of that nature. I mean, like, if you're looking for some sort of hard-hitting journalistic thing from that Q&A, then maybe you should read a Q&A that's not at the NHL Awards when all these guys are drunk and golfing. That's pretty much how it works. So she'll have stuff from after the show. Wednesday, so Wednesday, me and Merrick. Thursday, not sure. Probably not me and Merrick. It's media availability for the draft folks during the day. Friday, very good possibility that he and I will be doing a show live from the same hotel room. And then, of course, the draft Friday night and our party Thursday night. So probably one of those shows where we're a little bit hazy and rusty and feeling gleeful, having met all you good people on Thursday night and having imbibed more than our share of beverages as well. So anyways, thanks for joining us. Thanks for continuing to support the Silly Podcast. If you download it on iTunes and you have not left a, hey, you guys do a good job, here are a bunch of stars for you kind of review, we'd appreciate it. It always does help out our standing, and we could use some help because it's the summertime and less people are listening. Anyways, we'll catch you at some point tomorrow, probably 2 o'clock. That's when we do the show. Bye. Thank you.